get lost in the stars, so I can find someone who will fight.
Starkiller swiveled the pilot's chair toward the console and stared, without really seeing anything, until he was sure Coda had gone. Then he lowered his head into the blinking instruments and closed his eyes. The face of the empty moon rotated far below, unnoticed, irrelevant. He was doing the right thing. He was sure of it. The only question remaining was, where to start? Water. He looked up and began calculating a course for the first water world he thought of. Dak, the home of the Mon Calamari. Chapter 8. The cargo freighter touched down on Dak's moon with a dust-softened thump. Bail Organa, back in his grunt pilot's pressure suit, released the controls and set the instruments to standby. No one had followed them on the short journey, and no one would look twice at an authorized vessel in such an utterly uninteresting place. For as much time as they could spare, they would be unobserved and unsuspected of anything at all. "Nice spot for a summer palace," Juno said as Proxy went aft to warm up the R-22. "You should think about moving here. The quiet is tempting." Organa's wry tone perfectly matched hers. "But I don't think I'll be settling anywhere soon. The Emperor will get tired of looking for me eventually, and that's the time to reappear. There's a lot of work to be done out there." On that last point, Juno heartily agreed. They'd discussed the Senator's plans on the way from the surface. He believed that he was too well known to be assassinated in public. Robbed of the hope of quiet, out-of-sight murder, the Emperor, Organa said, would stick to the philosophy of keeping his enemies close and rely on other methods to deal with the growing rebellion. Juno supposed that he knew the Emperor better than anyone alive, except Darth Vader. But she wondered if he was as secretly as worried as she would have been. Painting a target on one's head and sticking it out into the firing line had never struck her as being particularly life-affirming, for oneself or one's family. "Any idea," she asked, "what this work you're planning to do might actually be?" "I know what you're really asking. You want to know which way I'll side with respect to Mon Mothma and Garmbel Iblis."
"Spot on, Senator."
"Well, it's a tricky question at the moment. With the Dak resistance movement on our side, we'll soon have more ships, but that doesn't mean we can afford to be complacent. One shipyard doesn't make us the equal of the Empire, and for that I'm glad. I don't trust that kind of power. A lesson learned the hard way is hard, perhaps impossible to unlearn. Assuming we don't all get killed along the way. Assuming that, yes." He looked at her with one hand cupping his cheek. "Where do you sit on this, Juno? You're not afraid of action, but I don't see you running off to start your own revolution." She didn't dodge the question.
"I think we need to act decisively, but smartly, too. What we did here, for instance, it made a difference. And if we'd taken Tarkin hostage, it might have made a big difference."
"Do you think the Emperor would have cared if we'd threatened to shoot Tarkin?" "I don't."
"No, but those around him might have. When the ruler of the galaxy doesn't lift a finger to save a Grand Moff, what kind of message does that send?"
"True." He nodded. "For what it's worth, I agree with you. There are tipping points and levers we can use to apply force all through the Imperial administration, and the sooner we start applying them, the sooner the Emperor will start to feel the pressure. But the importance of a symbolic victory should never be downplayed, and neither should the risks. Too many choices, too much at stake as ever. The future will judge us, not each other.
If we have a future. Oh, there's no doubt about that, Captain Eclipse. The question is, what sort?
Juno smiled, noting how cleverly he'd avoided giving a direct answer to her original question. But she didn't pursue it. It had been good seeing him, and she didn't want to spoil the moment with politics.
Pleasure serving with you again, Senator Organa, she said, extending her hand.
He gripped and shook it.
The feeling is mutual, Captain Eclipse.
I hope this won't be the last time I hear from you.
And vice versa.
That job's still going, remember? She rolled her eyes.
The best you could offer at the moment would be low-pay haulage. I did enough of that when I was with the Empire.
He laughed and saluted as she retreated to the cargo bay. Proxy had the R-22's landing lights on and the repulsors thrumming. She climbed up into the cockpit and slid easily into the pilot's seat next to him. When the hatch was sealed, Organa opened the bay doors and she guided the fighter outside, into the gray lunar light. Juno lifted a hand in farewell, knowing that Organa would be watching through the forward observation ports. The cargo freighter lifted off, hatch slowly sealing shut on its empty hold.
All systems are fully operational,
Proxy advised her.
We are ready to return to the fleet and report.
She wasn't looking forward to that. The question of what she should tell who remained very much open. Should she debrief with Leia, or report on developments with the Rebel Alliance leadership?
First, we have to find out where the fleet is exactly, she said. Plot a course for Malastare. That's the best place to start looking.
Yes, Captain Eclipse.
Juno tapped her index fingers on the instrument panel while Proxy performed the hyperspace calculations. The mission on deck had been an unqualified success, but it had left her with a faintly empty feeling, as though opportunities had been missed and the obvious overlooked. She didn't know where that feeling came from exactly. Perhaps no more than because every time she worked with Bail Organa one-on-one, it reminded her of Starkiller. On Felucia, they had discussed the mystery surrounding his past and whether she trusted him. On Corellia, they had been looking for Proxy, lest information the droid contained fell into the enemy's hands. This time, there had been no mention of Starkiller, but thoughts of him had been unavoidable. If he hadn't died, Kota wouldn't have died. If Kota hadn't died, they wouldn't have been on Dak in the first place. The shadow he cast still stretched long over the rebellion, a year after his death. She physically shook herself. How much longer would it take before she got over him? Hadn't she grieved enough?
Coordinates prepared. Are you well, Captain Eclipse?
Yes, she said, rubbing her eyes and telling herself to get a grip. I'm all right. Give me the controls. I'll take us there.
Yes, Captain.
The R-22 hummed under her hands, ready for dust-off. She took a deep breath. This was what life was about, she reminded herself. The roar of engines, the flow of data, the magical yet utterly mechanical routine of traveling from A to B through hyperspace. She'd missed being directly behind the controls of a ship. That was the one thing she regretted about accepting the commission to command the Salvation. She wondered briefly how Nitram and her crew were faring without her. They felt unimaginably distant, like a dream she'd once had, like the past she couldn't call back. Enough, she told herself, and hit the repulsors with a firmness that surprised her. She slept briefly during the hyperspace jump, in several short bursts. It was a long journey, from the outer rim on one side of the galaxy to the mid-rim on the other. First they followed the Overik grip link to Quermia, where they joined the busy Perlemian trade route. The risk of discovery was greater where traffic flowed most readily, so at Anti-Meridius they took a side route, following the Trilus trade route around Hutspace all the way along the Galactic Arms to the Corellian Run. There they took a series of complicated legs incorporating parts of the Lonic Spice Run, the Five Veils Route, and the Sanraf 6 Corridor to an uninhabited world called Dagobah on the Rima Trade Route. They followed that particular route to the Hydean Way, and thus came to Malastair from the opposite direction to the one she had originally set out on. Juno stretched as far as she could in the cramped cockpit when the high-gravity world hove into view. Orbit was a mess of ships, displaying Imperial and Independent transponders. The world's last chief magistrate had been transferred, thanks to his habit of shooting the locals for sport, and the Empire's rule had been contested ever since. High-gravity AT-AT walkers hunted for rebel outposts in deserts, while insurgency groups picked off Imperial officials in the city. Both indigenous Dugs and settled Gran fought fiercely alongside each other to maintain their independence. Juno hoped the citizens of Dak would look to Malastair as an example of how to proceed in the coming months. Even here, she realized with a sinking heart, was a reminder of times past. The former chief magistrate had been Ozzik Stern, who'd moved from Malastair to Kashyyyk, where he had come last in an encounter with Starkiller. Ripples in a pond, she thought, as she had over Cato Nymoidia. Starkiller had been a particularly large pebble. She took the controls and descended on course for Port Pixelito, the world's capital city and largest spaceport. A trio of TIE fighters buzzed her, but she easily outflew them. Unlike Dak and Cato Nymoidia, Malastair had little the Empire actually wanted. Otherwise, there would have been Star Destroyers descending en masse to remind the world of where its loyalties should lie. The low-level campaign against its citizens was just enough to remind them that they shouldn't get too comfortable. Their time would come. Port Pixelito was a tangled sprawl of low, squat buildings, as befit the higher gravity. Air traffic was lighter and less regulated than elsewhere, and Juno guided her straining R-22 to an empty berth without needing to register with the local authorities. Malastair was, effectively, a free port for non-Imperials, making it a perfect place for the Rebel Alliance to reallocate goods and staff. She had visited several times prior to gaining command of the Salvation, and made several important contacts as well. The man she was coming to see was just one of them. The repairman. When the starfighter was in its berth, she shut down the engines and popped the hatch. City smells rushed in, prompting her to pull a face. A crumbling civil administration had disadvantages too. "Stay with the ship," she told Proxy. "If anyone comes near it, do your best Wookiee impersonation and scare them away. I won't be long."
"Yes, Captain Eclipse. I will inform you of any unexpected developments."
She checked the charge on her blaster and hurried off, scowling at a number of unsavory characters checking out the R-22's well-maintained lines. Poor security was another problem Malastair suffered from, thanks to the ongoing urban conflict. Starfighters were valuable machines that could be easily adapted to other purposes. Left unguarded, the R-22 wouldn't last an hour. Juno emerged from the spaceport and checked her bearings. The streetscape had changed somewhat since her last visit. At least one of the major landmarks was gone, probably demolished during a strike from either side. People brushed by her, grunting impatiently. She spotted a dozen different species in the first 10 seconds. There. She found the sign she was looking for and cut a path through the crowd toward it. In blinking yellow and green pixels, it promised repairs, no questions asked, and hung above the entrance to a green two-story building that might once have been a small theater. Graffiti advertising the latest pod race covered the walls almost entirely from ground to roofline. She had watched one of the planet's high-speed extravaganzas the last time she had visited. It had made even her pulse race. Juno walked through the door, brushing past an elderly insectoid Ryorian, clutching a dented gyro-stabilizer to his chest. He chattered something to her in a dialect she didn't understand, then hurried away.
"Another satisfied customer," said the Grand behind the shop counter,
smiling, hopefully. Its three stalked eyes blinked at her in the low light. Two Kawakian monkey lizards, possibly a rare breeding pair, chased each other across the tops of shelves stuffed with dusty machine parts. Their squawking voices were loud in the claustrophobic space.
"I'm looking for your boss," she told the Grand. "The repairman."
"Lots of people looking for him. Who says he's here?"
"He never goes anywhere. Tell him it's Juno."
The Grand hesitated, and then lowered its snout to speak into a comlink fixed to the counter. Its native tongue was another Juno couldn't interpret, but she heard her name mentioned at least twice. A voice answered in the same dialect, and the Grand nodded and pointed at the shelves.
"You know the way?"
"Unless you've changed it, sure."
The Grand pushed a concealed button and a section of the wall slid aside. Juno went through it and waited for the panel to close behind her. There was a moment of absolute darkness and silence, and then the inner panel clicked. She slid it aside and walked into the workshop. It was a mess of starship components, droid limbs, photoreceptors, sensors, wires, core processors, field generators, environmental units, and more. Stacks of parts stretched high up to the distant ceiling, while some hung suspended in nets cast from corner to corner. Several ramps led up and down to further layers, and Juno knew that the deepest levels contained the components required to make weapons and targeting computers. Many of the broken machines that came through the store contained information relating to the Empire's activities in the system and beyond. And the Rebel Alliance had gained valuable data by tapping into this inadvertent leak, as well as sourcing much of its military materiel from reclaimed or completely rebuilt items. She looked around, standing on the tips of her toes to see over the piles.
"Over here, Juno," called a familiar voice. "Come on through."
A mop of blonde hair was just visible on the far side of the room. She wound her way through the closed spaces of the workshop to where its owner was working. The main workbench had moved, but it looked about as messy as it had the last time she'd been here. Myriad fragments of a multitude of machines covered its surface, mixed with all the delicate tools of the trade, material, sonic, and laser. As she approached, the owner of the tools put down the blue-spitting lens he'd been working with and flipped back his visor.
"Well, well. It is you. Pull up a seat and tell me where you've been. You don't write, you don't call. I was beginning to get worried."
She dragged a stool over to the bench and gratefully perched herself on it. Her calves were killing her in the high G. The so-called and literal repairman, Berkelium Shire, was a human technician who'd been living on Molastair for more than a decade, and, after an initial hitch or two, had successfully ridden out the transition from imperial to independent rule. He was broad-shouldered and very strong, thanks to the local conditions, and his loyalty to the rebellion was matched only by his skill with machines. Juno couldn't tell how old he was, for the freshness of his features and skin were matched by stress and worry lines, the origins of which she'd never asked about. They had become friends over the months she'd helped the rebellion strengthen its hold on the planet. She'd lost count of the number of late nights they'd spent discussing tactics and drinking cheap Corellian whiskey. He'd sent her the occasional cheerful message since, letting her know that all was well on her old patch. She'd always been too busy to respond.
"I'm looking for the fleet," she said. "Do you know where it's moved to?"
"Hey, not so fast," he said with a grin. "I mean it. Tell me what you've been up to."
I won't let you go without having at least a half-hearted conversation.
She caught a faint edge to his tone and wondered if he suspected she might have turned traitor. That was a reasonable concern and a reassuring one. He shouldn't hand out the fleet's location without proper cause, even to someone he thought he knew.
"Well, you know I was promoted," she said.
"You told me that when you were last year. We've missed you in the sector."
"How's it going?"
She didn't want to tell him about her contretemps with Mon Mothma, but she found herself doing it anyway. It felt good, getting it off her chest. Shire had always been easy to talk to. There was something so direct and open about him. She saw no judgment at all in his cheerful blue eyes.
"Suspended, huh?"
He pushed a couple of fuses around his workbench with the tip of magnetic screwdriver.
"That must be hard."
"Well, I've been keeping busy."
"I bet. You couldn't help yourself. That droid of yours still playing up?"
"Actually, he's on the mend now. No more visual glitches, mostly. He worries sometimes about his lack of a primary program, though. I don't suppose you could help me with that?"
He shook his head.
"Afraid not. Specialized units like Proxy, you probably need to replace the whole core."
"That's what I figured, and they're thin on the ground. Thanks regardless."
"Anytime, Juno."
There was a small but awkward silence.
"So,"
she pressed him.
"The fleet, it's not far from here,"
he said, not taking his eyes off her.
"In the inner rim, just off the Hydean Way. Ever heard of a place called Nortra?"
"No," she said, "but I'll find it."
"Stick around the area and they'll find you."
"Thanks, Shire."
She hopped carefully down from the stool, mindful of twisting an ankle.
"Wait,"
he said, taking her arm.
"Do you really have to go so soon?"
"Places to be. Emperors to overthrow," she quipped.
"But you've only just got here. You haven't told me about what you're feeling these days, where your head is."
She didn't remember ever talking much about that kind of stuff with anyone, and it was her turn to wonder what was going on. Could he have notified Imperial agents who might already be converging on her location? She tried to pull away, but his grip was too strong. She did throw him off balance, though, and the gyros of his stool whined in complaint. From the waist down, he was entirely machine. His legs had been lost in the early days of Malastare's independence, when a thermal detonator had gone off in the middle of a squad of saboteurs he'd been helping, leaving him crippled. He had built the prosthetic himself and traded active combat for offering support behind the scenes, professing perfect satisfaction with his lot. But there were those worry lines. Was that what this was about, she wondered? Turning on those he felt were responsible for ruining his life.
"Let go of me, Shire."
He did so, immediately.
"Sorry, Juno. I don't mean to be pushy. I just wish you'd stay."
"I'll be back. Don't worry about that."
"No, I mean stay. Here. With me."
Understanding suddenly dawned, and she felt like an utter fool for misreading the cue so badly. Betraying her was the last thing on his mind.
"Don't," she said, backing away.
"Hear me out," he said. "I have to say this now. You left too quickly before, and you never responded to my messages."
"I don't want to hear it. I can't hear it."
"But maybe you need to hear it,"
he said, with much more than simple entreaty in his voice.
"You've been in a funk ever since that friend of yours was killed. I don't know who he was or what happened to him, but I can tell what he meant to you. I can read you, and I know you needed to grieve for him, for what you lost, believe me. I understand that all too well."
He wrapped the knuckles of his left hand against the metal of his mechanical stool.
"But it's been over a year now. Don't you think it's time to move on?"
She turned away to hide the pricking of tears in her eyes. Was it time? Yes, probably. Was she able to? No, it didn't seem that way. Starkiller came so readily to mind. It was like he was still with her, even in death. She couldn't move on until he was gone. But when would that be? Maybe never. And she didn't want to give Shire false hope. He was a good man. Handsome, smart, loyal, brave, and good-humored. He deserved better than her. She couldn't even speak to him now, let alone give him what he wanted. "I'm sorry," she said. "I think it might be better if you stopped worrying about me and moved on yourself." He was silent for a long time. When he finally spoke, his tone was subdued, but not resentful. "All right. I hope you don't think less of me for trying." "No," she said, turning back to face him. "And I hope you don't think less of me for saying no."
"That wouldn't be possible," he said with a brave smile.
She squeezed his broad shoulder, marveled briefly at the rock-hard muscles, and then hurried away. After the close dimness of the workshop, the light outside seemed very bright and the noise was deafening. Instead of going straight back to the landing bay, she scoured the streets until she found a food seller she remembered from her previous visits, a wise old Cantrosian who made the best pashi noodles she'd ever tasted. The hit of familiar and very powerful spices cleared her head almost immediately. She was able to push the stricken look in Shire's eyes out of her mind for long enough to start thinking about the safest route to the Inner Rim. There were so many interdictors stationed on the Hydean Way, pirates and Imperials alike. It wouldn't do to get caught by one of them. "It's been over a year now. Don't you think it's time to move on?" As she threaded through the crowd back to the landing bay, she thought she glimpsed Kota's silver topknot standing high above the heads in a crowd of haggling mercenaries. That was impossible, of course. He'd fallen on Cato Nymordia over a week earlier. Shaking her head and walking on, she admonished herself severely. When she started hallucinating dead friends, she knew she really was stuck in the past. Chapter 9. Dagobah was a small, green-brown world with no moons. It seemed utterly uninhabited, and further examination didn't prove that impression wrong. Starkiller checked the rest of the system, wondering if he'd come to the wrong planet, but there was no doubt. Its sibling worlds were boiling, airless, frozen, or gaseous. There was nowhere else to go but here, assuming he wanted to survive longer than a minute outside. For the 100th time, he asked himself what he was doing. There was no ready answer. Mon Calamari had been an utter dead end. With an Imperial administration boiling over from recent resistance activity, he had only barely managed to slice into records deeply enough to find out that no one called Juno Eclipse had ever officially come to the planet, let alone in the last week. With no other way to search for her open to him, he had been forced to retreat and think of something else. Unfortunately, another search through the forest had been fruitless. She was either dead, in hyperspace, or hiding somehow. The second was the most likely, of course. But a long wait and then another search had still given him nothing. If she was going somewhere, it was taking her a long time to get there. Studying a map of the galaxy in frustration, he had stumbled across a name that Kota had used, Dagobah. Starkiller had never heard of it before, and the ship's records had nothing to add, beyond its location. All he had to go on was Kota's brief mention of it.
go to the forests of Kashyyyk, or the caves of Dagobah, or wherever you think you'll find what you need, and let the galaxy die. The forests of Kashyyyk brought back memories of wood smoke and the face of a man who must have been his father, the original Starkiller's father. He had found his birth name there, but that wasn't where his quest was leading him now. He was going forward, not backward. His gut told him that there was nothing on Kashyyyk for him now. What Coda's gut was telling him was the issue. Had he mentioned Dagobah for a reason, or entirely at random? Was the Force moving him in ways even he didn't understand? Either way, Starkiller had no other leads to follow. Coda had jumped ship to Kaminor long ago, so Starkiller plotted a course to the Sluice Sector and raced to the distant world as fast as the Rogue Shadow was able. Now that he was here, he didn't know if he'd found something or gotten more lost than ever. Skimming over the planet's atmosphere, carefully cloaked in case there was someone watching, he detected no hint of Juno, but he could feel a pervasive aura radiating from the planet. Like Felucia, where the original Starkiller had fought Shaak-Ti and her young Zabrak apprentice, this world was rich with the Force. A multitude of life forms thrived in its rich biosphere, which only made it stranger to him that no one had settled there. Life was, in principle, a good thing, he reasoned. But living things weren't always good to one another. Perhaps Dagobah was infested with giant predators, or its vegetable life ate anything that moved, or something he hadn't come close to imagining. He would have to be careful if he were to land there. Was he going to do that? He weighed up the pros and cons as thoroughly as he could. On the one hand, he had no reason to think that anything useful to his quest lay on the planet below. On the other hand, Coda was no fool, and he had deep connections to the Force of his own, connections that might become apparent if explored more deeply. It was his own original instinct that convinced him. His first thought on leaving Vader had been to seek out Coda. On finding Coda, he'd been disappointed that he couldn't tell him anything about Juno's whereabouts, but maybe this was why Coda had been important. Turning away now might leave him more lost than ever, even if he couldn't see where this path might lead him. At the very least, he might find a place to meditate, as he had told Coda he was going in search of. Operating the Rogue Shadow's controls by feel, he followed his instincts down into the atmosphere and sought a safe landing spot. It wasn't easy. The tree canopy was dense and hid marshy, treacherous soil. Thick clouds clung to promontories and low mountain ranges, making them visible only to radar. He imagined a thousand hungry eyes peering up at him as he circled. Eventually, he decided on a narrow strip of isolated land, just visible through a gap in the clouds. The Rogue Shadow swooped down with repulsors whining and settled onto the green-furred soil. Nothing lumbered out of the undergrowth to taste it. No huge vegetable jaws closed shut around it. Nothing happened at all, which only made him more nervous. At least the ground was stable. He shut down the engines and waited as the ship grew quiet around him. A patter of rain rippled across the hull, sounding like asteroid fragments against shields. Streamers of mist blew through the trees. When he got up and opened the hatch, a powerful smell hit his nostrils. The mixture of pollen, pheromones and decay originated from all around him, from every living thing on the tiny world. He'd never encountered anything like it before. Felucia was more cloying, with a thick fungal edge. Raxus Prime was just rot all the way through. Kashyyyk's distinctive odor came from wood and its byproducts. Dagobah was something else entirely. Maybe, he thought, that stink was why no one had settled here. He jumped lightly from the ramp onto the mossy ground. Water dripped from trees and leaves all around him, maintaining a steady patter. There was no wind to raise a sudden tattoo. The air was thick and motionless, as though it never moved. Ever. Juno wasn't there. He was sure of that. But what was there? Where were the caves of Dagobah? He closed his eyes and let the Force tell him what it could. Life roiled around him, tugging his mind in a dozen directions at once. He let himself be buffeted, tilting his head from one side to the other, testing the flows. There was a hint of something unusual to the east, a knot in the Force unlike any he had felt before. It drew him and repelled him at the same time. The longer he studied it, the more he felt as though it was studying him right back. He opened his eyes. A large reptilian bird was staring at him from the trees. Its black eyes blinked, but otherwise, it didn't move. With a flutter of leathery wings, another of its kind swooped in to join it. Starkiller reached behind him to seal the rogue shadow's hatch. Then he ignited one lightsaber as a precautionary measure. Still, the reptavians didn't move. With every sense alert for danger, he loped off into the swampy forest. The giant slug had 24 legs and a mouth full of teeth. 8 meters from snout to tail, it loomed over him, roaring. Its breath was vile. Starkiller hacked a double line down its belly with both his lightsabers and jumped to avoid the rush of foulness that released. Among the body parts expelled from the creature's stomach was the head of one of the giant reptiles he'd encountered farther back. The slug writhed and whined in pain. He left it to die in its own time. His destination was close. He forced his way through a tangle of long, leg-like roots, scattering a clutch of big white spiders as he went. The knot he had felt lay dead ahead, at the base of the largest tree he had seen so far. Despite its size, the tree looked sick with a malevolence that surprised him. If Dagobah as a whole was alive with the Force, then this tree had been poisoned by the dark side. His searching gaze found a deep hole choked with roots and vines at its base. This was undoubtedly the source of the poison that had ruined the tree. A lingering evil lurked here, wedded to the place as firmly as the tree itself. Its roots dug deep and stretched far. He approached more cautiously, no longer worrying about the planet's more obvious predators. Was this the cave Kota had alluded to? Part of him hoped it wasn't, even as he yearned for this particular part of his mission to be over. Juno wasn't here, and he didn't want to be either, any longer than he had to. There was a clearing in front of the cave. He ran to it and braced himself to enter the cave. His head was thick with foreboding. He felt as though black tendrils were reaching into his mind, stirring up memories that had been mercifully dormant until now. The voices of Darth Vader and Jedi Master Shakti warred within his mind, as though fighting over who controlled him.
The dark side is always with you.
You are Vader's slave.
Your hatred gives you strength.
You could be so much more.
You are, at last, a master of the dark side.
Are you prepared to meet your fate? A gentle tapping brought him out of his mental deadlock. He spun around with both lightsabers upraised. Something was watching him. A
tiny green creature dressed in swamp-colored rags with green skin, long pointed ears, and a heavily lined face. It stood on a log with the help of a short cane that it held in both hands, and it was this that made the tapping noise. The creature didn't flinch at the sight of the lightsabers. Its brown eyes were alive with amusement, if anything. It nodded once at him. In acknowledgement or recognition, Starkiller couldn't tell, and the cane ceased its gentle tap-tap. He lowered his blades and, after a moment, deactivated them as well. He sensed no threat from this unexpected being. Quite the opposite, in fact. The yawning void of the cave seemed to retreat for a moment, clearing his mind of confusion. The being before him might be small in stature, but he was much greater than he looked. "You guard this place?" Starkiller asked him, gesturing at the cave with the hilt of one of his lightsabers. The creature chuckled as though pleased by the question.
"Oh-ho! Only a watcher am I now."
"Then you'll let me pass?" That earned him a shrug.
"Brought you here, the galaxy has. Your path, clearly this is."
Starkiller turned and looked behind him into the cave mouth. The swamp jungle had fallen utterly silent around them. The air was as thick as glass. "You know what I'm looking for?" Something poked the back of his knee. He jumped. The little creature had hopped off the log and approached close enough to test him with his cane. So lightly and silently that Starkiller hadn't noticed.
"Hey!"
The creature persisted, poking his flight suit and lightsabers and gloves and dissecting him with intense eyes.
"Something lost? A part of yourself, perhaps?"
Starkiller brushed him away, profoundly unnerved by the accurate and unasked-for reading of the situation. "Maybe."
"Whatever you seek, only inside you will find."
The creature settled back with his hands on his cane, staring up at Starkiller with so powerful a gaze that for a moment he felt as though he were being looked at from a great height. All trace of humor was gone. "Inside," he repeated. The tip of the cane lifted, pointed at the cave. Starkiller hesitated. The insidious pressure of the hole in the tree roots grew stronger, and his mind clouded again. "Be careful, boy," said Kota from the past. "I hear the long shadow of the dark side reaching out to you." Like a diver preparing for a long descent, he took a deep breath and entered the cave. It was dark inside, of course, but somehow it managed to be even darker than he'd expected. He struggled through the thick curtains of roots and vines, resisting the urge to slash at them with his lightsabers. He kept his weapons carefully inactive, intuitively understanding that any aggressive move that he took might be reflected back at him 100-fold. Intuition was all he had to guide him now. His groping fingers encountered a wall of stone ahead of him. Instead of a dead end, however, he found that the cave bent sharply to his right. He pressed on, feeling the dark side throbbing in his ears and beating against his useless eyes. The air seemed to vibrate. Every breath made him want to scream, but in dismay or delight, he couldn't tell. Another wall ahead of him. This time, the tunnel turned to his left. His grasping hands were wet with moisture. He could see them now somehow, reaching ahead of him as he felt his way into the far reaches of the cave. Gradually, the vines fell away, leaving just the roots to obstruct him. Through a dreamlike fog, he stumbled into a larger chamber, the outer limits of which were obscured. He looked down at his feet but couldn't see them either. The ground was hidden by a crawling gray mist. He realized with a shock that his flight suit was gone. He was now somehow wearing the traditional robes of a Jedi Knight. A flash of memory came to him then of seeing himself exactly like this on Kashyyyk, wielding his father's blade. He heard himself asking Darth Vader,
Your spies have located a Jedi?
Yes. General Ram Kota. You will destroy him and bring me his lightsaber.
The voices from his memory seemed to echo through the room, whispering, tugging him on. At once, Master.
One more test.
As you wish, my Master.
One step closer to your destiny.
Will not fail you, Lord.
Do not disappoint me.
He emerged into a much larger cave. The fog cleared, revealing muddy walls overgrown with roots. The floor was treacherous underfoot. He walked carefully forward, seeking the source of the whispers, but stopped dead on realizing that the tangled roots ahead of him were moving. It was too dark to see properly. The time had come to shed some light on his unusual situation. Igniting both his blades, he held them up above his head, crossed in an X. The light they cast was blue, not red. That was the first unnerving detail. By their cool light, he made out something hidden by the roots. And it was this that was moving, struggling against the winding net. He stepped warily closer, peering into the shadows. Was that an arm he saw, with a hand clutching vainly at freedom? Was this a hallucination, a vision, or something that was really happening? A face shoved forward through the muddy roots. Starkiller gasped and stepped back, bringing his lightsabers down between him and the figure caught in the roots. He recognized those features. They were his own, lean and desperate and full of hunger. Movement came from his right. Another body struggled against the grasping vegetation. Another version of him. And another. They were all around him. Dozens of them. Writhing, twisting, straining, whispering in agony. Yes, my master. I am strong, my master, and I am getting stronger. When will my training be complete, master? They wore the black uniforms of Kamino. They were clones like him.
What will you do with me?
Starkiller shuddered and moaned. He looked about for an exit from the chamber and saw a narrow crack in the stone. He lunged for it, but not so quickly that he avoided the hands that clutched at him. They gripped his flight uniform with his own strength, trying to hold him back, entrap him with them where he belonged. He cried out and pulled free, falling back into the chamber. He raised his lightsabers automatically, thinking to hack his way free.
Kill me, and you destroy yourself.
He heard the voice clearly, as he had on Kashyyyk. That time, he had not hesitated to strike down the doppelganger he'd seen in his mind. This time, he listened to himself and once more extinguished his blades. The decision renewed his strength, gave him the courage to continue. In the near darkness, he faced the clutching hands of his other selves and pushed firmly through them. Their slippery fingers skidded off his flight uniform and fell away. Behind him, their whispers became moans and then faded to silence. All he could hear now was his breathing, fast and heavy, as though he had been running. He'd been underground for hours, or so it felt. How much farther until he reached the end of the cave and found what he was looking for, or what was looking for him? Another chamber, this one swirling with shadows. He kept walking, and the shadows rose up around him, forming short-lived figures that loomed and retreated, blocking his path. He tried to force his way past them, as he had with the visions of his other selves, but found himself confused and disoriented. His head spun. Twice he found himself facing the way he'd come. He put out both hands to stop the world turning. There had to be a way out somewhere, if only the cave would let him find it. He could hear rain in the distance, and he stumbled toward it. Thunder boomed, and suddenly he was standing in the cloning facility on Kamino, near the hole he'd ripped in the wall during his escape. Visible through the hole, the sky hung wild and low, racked by a fierce electrical storm. Spray-slicked metal gleamed even in the gray light. The howl of wind was relentless and eerie. A figure walked closer to the hole in order to inspect the torn metal. Armored from head to foot, in gray and green, with an unfamiliar T-shaped visor and some kind of jetpack affixed to his back, his voice had the inflectionless grate of a vocoder. It was clear, though, that he wasn't a droid. Perhaps his vocal cords had been damaged.
He has a healthy head start.
Starkiller moved closer. Only when he moved did he recognize the closeness of armor, the heaviness of limb, the sensation of being trapped. He had experienced all these sensations before. He said, in leaden tones,
"The Empire will provide whatever you require, Bounty Hunter."
Starkiller strained to move his former master's limbs, but he was powerless to do anything other than ride out the vision. He could only see through Darth Vader's eyes and wait for it to end.
"I'll need backup,"
said the green-armored figure. Starkiller's black-gloved left hand gestured out the hole toward the landing pad. There, a long line of troopers was marching into two Lambda-class shuttles, followed by a type of droid he had never seen before. It was huge, with long legs, powerful armament, and heavy shielding. It was so big, the full extent of it was hidden behind the buildings near the landing bay. The bounty hunter turned to Starkiller and said in a satisfied tone,
"They'll do."
A flurry of rain obscured the view, and he was back in his body, and the shadows were retreating, forming a dense knot in front of him. He reeled away from it, holding his hands in front of him. They were flesh and blood, with no sign of prosthetics. He was himself, wholly and only himself, which came as a great relief, even as the knowledge that his former master was hunting him sank in. That was what the vision had been telling him beyond all doubt. He thought himself free, but Darth Vader thought otherwise. The shadows swirled and burst apart and came rushing at him, filling his head. With an image of Proxy, which surely couldn't be possible, since he'd been destroyed by Darth Vader on Corellia. This had to be something from the past, Starkiller decided. But when and where and who was he now? There was none of the heaviness of Vader, and no sign of an Imperial presence at all. He was on a ship of some kind, a large one, bigger than the Rogue Shadow. Crew members rushed around him, briskly but without urgency. They wore uniforms identical to the ones he had trained against on Kamino. Soldiers of the Rebel Alliance. A canine-faced officer turned to face him.
"I'm having trouble with the forward sensor array, Captain."
Starkiller looked through the observation canopy, out at the space ahead. A small cluster of ships dotted the view, accompanied by an escort of Y-wings. In the backdrop hung a dense and beautiful nebula, all curls and swirls, glowing every color of the spectrum. A familiar voice asked, "Interference from the nebula?" Proxy turned from an instrument he was studying.
"Perhaps. I'll try to pin it down."
"Let's not take any chances." Starkiller barely heard the words. He was stunned by the knowledge that it was Juno speaking. He was experiencing what she was experiencing. Whatever had happened to her would happen to him now. He punched a button on the console with her hand, not his.
"This is Captain Eclipse."
Her voice echoed through the ship.
"Set defensive protocols throughout all ships. Prime your shields and check your scanners for anything that's not one of ours."
The canine-faced officer nodded and checked the screens in front of him.
"All clear, Captain."
"Keep looking, Nitram. We can't be too careful."
"Of course, sir."
Starkiller watched the screens with her, searching for any sign of disturbance. His senses prickled.
something was coming. She could feel it, and therefore he could too. A voice crackled over the comm.
Captain Eclipse, we're picking up six small warships coming in fast!
Explosions puffed alongside a ship ahead. Starkiller didn't see where the attacking vessels had come from, but he could see what they were doing. Four precisely aimed missiles cracked the ship in two, sending crew and air gushing into the void. With one ship down, the focus of the attack turned to the center of the group, the ship containing Juno.
Shields to full,
she called over the intercom.
Open fire, all batteries!
An impact rocked the deck beneath her. The bridge swayed.
We've been breached,
said her second in command.
Troopers boarding!
Send a security detail to the main reactor. Seal off life support. Another explosion, closer than before. Rebel crew went flying, but Juno held on to her post.
Get those deflector shields up!
Proxy leaned into view.
Internal security beacons are going crazy. Captain Eclipse, I think we should...
The bridge doors blew in. Smoke and burning debris filled the air. Through the clouds stalked two heavily armed troopers, already firing. Juno ducked down, blaster pistol in hand. One precise shot to the throat seal put one of the troopers down. Another barely missed the second. Four more troopers rushed into the bridge. The maze of blaster fire intensified. Starkiller felt his heart racing as he edged to a better vantage point, picking off troopers as best he could. His crew died around him. First, Proxy, blown backward in a shower of sparks. Then the dog-faced second-in-command. Rage rose up in him, pure and clean. He stood up in order to see more clearly through the thickening smoke. A blaster bolt took him in the shoulder, sending him spinning sideways, falling. And when he hit the ground in the cave, he realized that although it had been Juno's heart pounding all along, he still kept perfect time with hers. He was covered in sweat, and the stink of the smoke was thick in his nostrils. The pain of the bolt to Juno's arm hurt all the more for knowing that he hadn't been there to stop it. The timing of the vision tormented him. Juno hadn't been captain of anything larger than the Rogue Shadow while Proxy had lived, or while the original Starkiller had lived, for that matter. She hadn't been shot either. Was it conceivable that Proxy had been brought back to life, or simply replaced? He had seen other droids of his make on Kamino, so that wasn't impossible. That placed the vision sometime after the events of the Death Star. But when? Had they already happened, or were they still to come? Could he prevent them from happening? He struggled to his hands and knees. The shadows crowded him, made it hard to move. His lightsaber hilts had fallen from his hands and rolled out of sight. He scrabbled about for them in the gloom, but they were nowhere to be found.
Give them back, he told the shadows.
Give them back!
All they gave him was another vision. He was crouched on a metal surface, holding Juno in his arms. Rain pounded them. Her eyes were closed. She was covered in blood. He was covered in blood. She wasn't breathing. He tipped his head back and howled back at the storm. The image of Juno faded into nothing, and he fell face forward onto the muddy ground of the cave, as though gravity had multiplied 1,000 times. In that vision, he had definitely been himself. It was either the future or a past he could no longer remember, or the work of another clone, or some equally bizarre possibility he could not for the moment fathom. We form a strong team, said her voice out of the past. It's unfortunate we can't keep on as we are. The memory gave him strength to resist the terrible weight of the shadows. Juno had said that on their return to the Empyrical, at which time he'd expected to help Darth Vader overthrow the Emperor, and she, he had assumed, would have been allocated to other duties. She had been wrong then, and this vision might be wrong now. Past, present, future. If anyone could change it, it would be him.
Juno could not die. The pressure fell away. He leapt to his feet. His lightsabers flew out of the shadows and landed in his hands and were lit an instant later. They were red once more, as red as the blood in his final vision. The shadows fled. By the crimson light, he could see that there was nowhere else to go. He had reached the end of the caves. The only direction he had left to go was back. He steeled himself for a repeat of his clawing other selves, just in case the cave wasn't finished with him yet, and pressed on his way. Even the murky swamp light seemed bright and green to his eyes when he finally staggered out of the cave. The air smelled sweet and fresh. He clung to a fall of tangled vines and gave himself a moment to recover. He felt utterly drained by what lay behind him, and utterly daunted by what lay ahead. Juno could not die. That was the only thing keeping him going. The click of a tiny wooden cane brought him out of his thoughts. His head came up. His searching gaze found the little creature sitting on a rock, calmly watching him. How he stayed so close to the cave was beyond Starkiller. He could feel the dark side rolling in waves at him. The undertow was powerful. He had only just escaped. To be constantly within range of such an assault and to remain sane, or what passed for it on this sodden, forgotten world, was utterly inconceivable to him. The little creature possessed a power out of all proportion to his appearance.
"Whatever you have seen,"
he said, pointing the tip of his cane at Starkiller's heaving chest.
"Follow it, you must."
Starkiller nodded. If that was wisdom, then he shared it. "To the ends of the galaxy, if I have to." The creature returned his nod and lowered the cane. His eyes closed, and Starkiller knew that his audience, if such it was, had ended. Leaping out of the clearing, propelled by a sense of urgency that transcended time and space, he ran as fast as he could for the rogue shadow. Chapter 10. Nordra was another high-gravity world, but one that was extremely tectonically active, with numerous precipitous mountain ranges crisscrossed by deadly blue glaciers. From orbit, Juno spied several low-altitude lakes of bubbling lava, alongside which the inhabitants had built several heat-devouring cities. She tapped into their local version of the HoloNet news, Nordfeed, and found a hardy, if not particularly lofty race, that had learned to live with constant physical threat and danger. Some of the reports were openly critical of the Emperor's policies. Only their isolation saved them, Juno suspected. Although technically on the Hydean Way, the well-traveled hyperroute detoured around a nearby nebula, bypassing Nordra and several other nearby worlds. Juno bided her time waiting for the Rebel Alliance to pick up her transponder by half-watching Nordfeed, half-staring blankly out her viewport at the vast and beautiful nebula ahead, all the while trying very hard not to think about Berkelium Shire. She hadn't intended to hurt him. She had thought they were only friends. She had valued his friendship and was guilty only of wanting everything to stay the same between them, even though she knew now that it could never be. They couldn't go back, but they couldn't go forward either. She wasn't ready for anything like that, and she didn't want to be ready, ever. It seemed stupid even to think it. But if she couldn't have Starkiller, then she wouldn't have anyone. His death had left such a huge empty space in her life that no one seemed likely to fill it.
"We have you on our scopes, R22,
came a voice over the comm.
"Identify."
She scanned her own screens but couldn't pin down the source of the transmission. There were 5 ships in orbit around Nordra, any one of which could belong to the Rebel Alliance. Possibly all of them did. "Juno Eclipse," she broadcast. "Authorization Onda Kovran 23-1791.
Is the Solidarity here?
The Salvation too, Captain. Here are the coordinates.
She fed the data into the Navicom, thinking, still Captain. That was a welcome sign.
These coordinates are on the other side of the nebula.
Proxy warned her. Ion drive only, I presume. She checked with the Rebel contact.
You presume correctly. The Tani Nebula is diffuse for the most part, but it casts a big enough mass shadow to ruin your day.
Understood. Thanks. She fired up the ion drives and pulled the starfighter out of orbit. Ion drive would take longer, but it was worth it to ensure that the Alliance fleet couldn't be surprised by ships appearing out of hyperspace right on top of them. Thus far, Commodore Vidas had managed to keep one step ahead of the Empire's spies, but it was only a matter of time before something critical leaked. And that, she told herself, was of much greater concern than a broken heart. Juno docked with the Solidarity and turned the R-22 back over to the hangar crew. She half expected to find Leia or her droid waiting for her, but the welcoming committee awaiting her consisted solely of an aide asking her to meet the Commodore in his quarters immediately. She said she would. No off-the-record chats in the officer's mess this time, she thought. That could be a good or a bad thing.
You should consider yourself fortunate, Proxy, she said as they wound their way through the ship's corridors.
Not having a primary program means you don't have to worry about losing it.
I do not feel fortunate, Captain Eclipse. It makes me wonder if droids have a layer of programming even more fundamental than the one I am missing. A layer that makes us feel incomplete without instructions. We are built not just to serve, but to crave to serve. I cannot decide if this is slavery or a form of liberation.
From choice, you mean?
From doubt.
Juno wished she could alleviate her own doubts by undergoing a quick memory wipe and restoring her factory presets. She saluted the sentry outside Vidas's door and was waved through. The Rodian Commodore was sitting behind a desk, studying charts. He half stood when she entered and waved her to a seat. Then he sat back down again. Proxy stayed by the door, yellow eyes watching unblinkingly.
Congratulations, Captain Eclipse,
was Vidas's opening remark.
The inquiry found you not guilty of putting Alliance resources and staff in undue peril.
Thank you, sir, she said, feeling an immediate lightness in her chest.
As of now, you are reinstated to full rank, privileges, and security clearance. But of course, you have a whole new hurdle to leap over.
Sir,
there's a meeting of Alliance leadership in half an hour to discuss the situation on deck. You've been asked to attend.
By whom?
By Mon Mothma.
Juno nodded. I don't suppose I could get back in my starfighter and circle the nebula until it's over.
Not a chance. And we'll know if you send that droid of yours in your place.
Vidas's antenna twitched in something that might have been amusement.
Go freshen up. I'll have someone call your droid when we're ready.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, and you might be interested to know, Captain, that your mission to Cato Nymoidia is now being considered a success.
Juno frowned, thinking of Kota.
How is that possible, sir?
Baron Tarko was killed during insurgent action shortly after you left. Clearly you started something that someone else chose to finish. That's all.
She returned his salute and left the room, still puzzling over this latest development. There was very little to think of it, though, except to feel fortunate that someone had done her that favor. If she ever found out who it was, she would be sure to express her heartfelt thanks. With Cato Nymoidia now seen in a more positive light, it would be easier